Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sweeney, and today on the show, we're talking about a startup on a mission to bring the woolly mammoth back to life. Spun out of George Church's legendary biology lab at Harvard, Colossal Bio is using a suite of cutting-edge technologies, from genetic engineering to artificial wombs, to create a de-extinction playbook, a toolkit for bringing endangered species back from the brink and even bringing extinct species back to life. I won't call it Jurassic Park, but as you'll hear in the interview, the lead investor is one of the original creators of Jurassic Park. So, Colossal Bio has raised $75 million to date and is just getting started. I hope you enjoy this interview with Colossal Bio CEO, Ben Lamb. Marketing is a key hire for startups, but finding the right people is a task. Marketer Hire leverages AI and in-house recruiters to find elite marketing professionals fast. Sign up for a no-risk trial at marketerhire.com. Ben, it is great to have you on the show. To dive right in, what is de-extinction and what are you building at Colossal?
Colossal is kind of, I guess, now the quintessential de-extinction company. And our focus is just doing just what it sounds. We're trying to end extinction by building a series of tools and technologies that we can leverage for both species preservation of critically endangered species, as well as bring back species that have been lost that serve a ecological or fill an ecological void that existed with their loss.
So Jurassic Park, but in real life.
I will say that several conversations that I've had both publicly and on stage have started with that famous music. But no, I mean, you know, we're not engineering dinosaurs and sticking frog DNA in things that we try to pull from amber. None of that's even real. What we're actually trying to do is we're really trying to work with critically endangered species, right? And so if you look at the work that we're doing in elephants on our path to the mammoth, it actually could be very beneficial to elephant conservation. So I don't think of it as Jurassic Park, even though because we're doing bringing back extinct species using genetic engineering, I think a lot of people quickly go to that reference. And it probably doesn't help sometimes that, you know, our largest investor, Thomas Tull, was also the executive producer of Jurassic Park. So I think there's some interesting things like that that, you know, make people even more excited about comparing us to Jurassic Park along the way.
How does this actually work? What are you doing with elephants? Where does this play into broader extinction? And how do you see a business model kind of arising out of this CRISPR and DNA technology that you're working on for rare animals and species?
Ultimately, what we're doing is really genetic reconciliation, right? We're combining the genes of extinct species, in this case, the woolly mammoth, with its closest phylogenetic relative being the Asian elephant, to exude the phenotype or physical attributes that represents the cold tolerance in elephants. So that's everything from, like, you know, long shaggy coats, just dome cranium, to small ears, how they handle hemoglobin production, how their nerve endings actually adapt to up to negative 40. And so what George Church and what his lab and Ariane and a bunch of other people previous to starting Colossal were working on is all of the comparative genomics and the computational biology of what are those cold tolerant genes, how are they represented. And then we leverage genetic engineering, including a wide variety of tools, including base editing, CRISPR, or other genetic engineering technologies to essentially take those genes from a mammoth, insert them back into that architecture of an Asian elephant to create an eventually embryo that exudes both the Asian elephant core architecture as well as the phenotypes. A lot of times we like to call it an Arctic elephant because, you know, an Asian elephant is 99.6% a woolly mammoth to date, like already without any genetic modifications because it is the closest phylogenetic relative. And then from there, you know, we're just modifying 45 genes in order to, exude the physical attributes of the mammoth that also represents cold tolerance. So the benefit is cold tolerance. But you also have the woolly mammoth genes that, you know, makes an Arctic elephant look more like a woolly mammoth than an Asian elephant.
This has got to be some of the most fundamental experimentation that we've done on living mammals and creatures of this size, right?
I mean, it's definitely groundbreaking science. You know, I think from a synthetic biology perspective, I think it's more interesting than working on, you know, yeast or other single cell organisms, right? And so that actually really helps us because we're attracting some of the most incredible talent worldwide, you know, to help us kind of on in this journey, which is amazing. And ultimately though, you know, all of the technologies that we need in order for us to achieve our goal of de-extinction of the mammoth and eventually other species already exist, right? On some level, right? But there's not massive science gates that exist for us to kind of like overcome in the process. We like to think of it as, like George likes to say, it's more like hard engineering, but a lot of the fundamentals already exist today, right? It's not like we're having to solve, you know, cold fusion or faster than light travel or break some laws of physics, right, in order to achieve this. We have what we need, but it's all about making it more efficient. It's about removing kind of the brute force nature out of it. How do we leverage software? How do we leverage wetware, robotics, all of the right kind of tool sets in order for us to be more efficient and also do things at scale is something that we're really, really focused on. But ultimately, to your point, it is cutting edge science. It is cutting edge engineering. And you know, from that, you know, like any big engineering project, whether it's going to the moon or something else, a lot of technologies come out of that, right? And to your earlier question around business model, you know, our focus right now is just on the science, but there are technologies that, you know, both software, wetware in the lab, and then eventually hardware, like ExoDev and artificial wombs, that can be really, really helpful to critically endangered species, livestock production, or even humans long term, right? If you look at technologies around, you know, multiplex editing multiple genes. So, you know, our hope is that along the path, we develop some pretty interesting technologies that have applications much further reaching than de-extinction.
It's wild, the stuff that could come out of a project like this. What are some of those pieces? You said we have all the pieces technologically, and you mentioned, you know, hardware, software, robotics. But when you think about the steps, I mean, CRISPR, in vitro fertilization, what are kind of the core pieces that you're putting together to build the mammoth?
It's next gen sequencing, which the world's done a really good job of like commoditizing, right? Like, and we're not just, you know, doing assembly on ancient DNA. We're also doing a lot of population genomic studies. We're also doing a lot of studies with existing Asian elephants. We're working very closely with large conservation groups, as well as the Vertebrate Genome Project and others, in order to genetically back up critically endangered species. We're very focused on elephants. So it may not surprise you that we're working heavily on elephants to start from that. And then also helping cure diseases like EEHV, you know, in elephants. So all of kind of the how we can leverage genetic engineering and genetic tools for backup and helping existing elephants is pretty critical outside of the sequencing work. And then when you start to look at kind of the toolkit, whether it's leveraging CRISPR, leveraging several other technologies in our biology team's toolkit in order to make the edits, you've sometimes used like mouse models and whatnot along the way. Once you get to that point, you can get to where you get to viable embryos. Then you go through the process of somatic cell nuclear transfer. And then you kind of have the path of surrogacy or artificial wombs. For our long-term goals of rewilding, you know, we really want artificial wombs so that you can get to the production level. And I think that from an engineering challenge perspective, that is kind of one of the largest applications in terms of like not just of opportunity with artificial wombs, but the largest applications for overcoming engineering challenges, you know, full ExoDev from, you know, obviously an embryo all the way to term. And in that, in an elephant, you know, it's 22 months. So and it's actually quite large. So it's not a very small initiative on the ExoDev side, but the applications for it are really interesting, you know, long-term for animals, for studying gestation, for understanding kind of core reproductive biology and developmental biology, all the way to, you know, fast forward way in the future of how it can, you know, help premature babies and everything else, right? And so I think the applications of some of the technologies, even if we don't go into these necessarily fields, are pretty interesting. And you know, we can achieve our goals of bringing back, you know, select species like the mammoth through things like surrogacy, but really to get to the scale we want, artificial wombs is pretty critical.
That's fascinating. So genetic sequencing, advances in CRISPR, and then also artificial wombs to actually be able to.
Yeah. And when you put that together, right? I mean, obviously there's many, many subsets to what you just said and what I just said, but when you put that together, you kind of form this like de-extinction toolkit. And so how that could be leveraged with small populations like the northern white rhino and others is really, really interesting, right? So it's like, how can we find if there's a species that only has a few left, how can we leverage, next gen sequencing, even stem cell reprogramming like gametogenesis? Like, how do we, instead of like extracting egg cells from, one or two of the last of its kind, why don't we make egg cells using stem cell reprogramming and then create embryos from that? And then how do you leverage that and grow it in artificial wombs at the scale that you want, right? So we are not an animal company that just is going to raise a ton of animals. You really got to have, and rewild them. We really need to have best in class partners that know about the reintroduction of species back into their native habitat or within a small population group. And so that's an area that isn't as sometimes as sexy as the CRISPR or the artificial wombs, but it's really fascinating as we collaborate with a lot of conservation partners and understand all the different aspects of rewilding, which is also just really, really interesting.
You're almost like a foundational science research lab or industry in itself. And then from there, it sounds like you're going to be spinning out new products, whether it's new drugs for elephants or anything else.
Well, that should be free. So, I mean, anything that we do to help conservation should just go to the broader community, on our path. I think there's a lot of areas to monetize long-term in technologies and other ways. But ultimately, I think that a lot of these fundamental conservation tools and technologies should be available, right, to the broader conservation community. Even if some of the applications have human healthcare, we could just simply kind of split the field of use to ensure that the conservationists have the absolute best tools at their disposal, right? Because in a lot of cases, the incredible women and men doing conservation work and have boots on the ground are fighting a losing war, whether that's poaching, loss of habitat, pollution, small population that isn't breeding. They actually need more and more kind of advanced tools in their kind of like tool belt to fight some of these challenges.
So, two-part question. First is, how do you figure out what to do next? Like what to focus on when there are so many different directions you can go and so many problems that need to be solved? And then two, when you're going out and talking to VCs and positioning the business, how do you describe what you're going to be doing next, what the pipeline and the roadmap looks like?
So I guess the short answer is thoughtfully. So we do it very thoughtfully. It's not as random as it may seem. And so, there's a lot of parts to this, right? And so when you're not day-to-day involved in Colossal, it's like, oh, wait, they're building technologies, they're doing extinct species, they're working on conservation. It seems like a lot. But when you kind of like thread the needle across everything we're working with, one isn't more important than the other. Like the exodev work, the conservation work, the surrogacy work, the work on somatic cell nuclear transfer and cloning, the work on computational biology, the editing, all of that like fits together, right? It all fits together in order for us to kind of create this organism, right? And hopefully long-term other organisms. And so for us, I think it seems like sometimes we're doing a lot, but we are very, very thoughtful about kind of the approaches there. And then from a next perspective, we don't have it in mind, oh, we're going to build this many technologies, or we're going to spin out this many companies. For us, it's really about, we have our focus, which is on de-extinction and long-term rewilding. And in that process, where we find innovations that can be applicable to both animals and to potentially human healthcare, we then devote more resources. We haven't shared it yet publicly, but we are working on we built a software stack that's pretty helpful to us in the efforts that we have. We've had a handful of conversations with big biotechs and others. They think it's really interesting for some of their cancer and drug discovery research. So we may, take that technology and build that into something that could be, leveraged for more than just the de-extinction aspects. And so I think we've done a really good job of curating, our plan of how we get to de-extinction. and then in taking our investors on the journey of, like, you know, the path right now is focused on the mammoth. There will be other species that we've been focused on, you know, long term, that as long as they have serve an ecological impact to bringing them back, well, then we may focus on those. And then, you know, knowing that, to your point earlier, knowing that we're a research organization that's doing cutting edge science, there'll be tons of innovations that come out of that, whether it's a new novel way to make edits or DNA synthesis or DNA delivery, all the way to software and computational biology and AI driving some of the process, all the way to artificial wombs. So, you know, we don't have to have 20 technologies that spin out of this company for this company to be massively successful. You know, two or three that are, you know, massively impactful for human healthcare, as well as what we're leveraging for our de-extinction, I think would be an incredible win for us as a company and, you know, for our shareholders and investors. So I think it's just about that transparency and talking to our investors about what is the path that we're on, showing them every step in the process and exactly where we are on the process, and then what we're discovering is really, really key, and creating an open dialogue around what we think is interesting, you know, for human healthcare, as well as the de-extinction. That's kind of been, I think, the secret to kind of like our success with our current investors and, you know, hopefully future investors, is just having that dialogue and radical transparency around the discoveries that we're finding, which are really interesting. Every day, I feel like, you know, almost every week, it's like a year here. And like we learn, there's the pace of discovery is just super interesting right now.
How did you get here? I imagine there are a lot of people who are interested in this idea, but not many of them, you know, have partnered with George Church's lab, which is one of the most famous biotech labs in the world for spinning out new biotech startups. And not many have raised $75 million, especially for a problem like this.
Yeah, so I've started technology companies. And so I've had a handful of companies that I've started. Had a gaming company that got acquired, had a large mobile application development company that got acquired, had a conversational intelligence platform that got acquired. My last company was in common operating picture and satellite software for the Department of Defense. I love technology and love software and love learning new fields. And that's actually kind of the genesis of how a lot of this started. I called George just, you know, out of the blue, because being, you know, one of the fathers of synthetic biology, I thought it was a, you know, I believe that my super fascinated with the category. I knew I would build a synthetic biology company. I did know it'd be colossal or de-extinction. I thought it would be like some random software thing. But I reached out to George in order to understand what he was working on in the lab, what trends he was seeing, and then really try to find, I thought I'd find something more at the intersection of like synthetic biology and AI and software. We are finding that within the kind of the umbrella that is colossal, which is great. But, you know, when I was talking to George, you know, he was sharing a lot of things in his lab. But when he started talking about the Mammoth Project, his voice completely changed. I could tell a complete difference in his mood and tone. He was very excited about the other technologies, but I could definitely tell something different here. And so like a week or two later, I was in his lab actually talking to him about de-extinction, talking to him about elephant conservation technologies that could come from this. And he was just insanely excited, as was I. And I left there thinking, oh my gosh, I thought I was going to get some advice from George and some direction on where I could build the next software company, but apparently we're going to go build a de-extinction company. And then every day since then, I feel like I've fallen more and more in love with it, which just makes it even better, right? Like I've been very, very fortunate to work with really smart people and do really cool things. But this, you know, I've never kind of woken up day to day and like the, you know, even on the hardest day at Colossal, it's pretty enjoyable.
What is George like? And for our audience who might not know a lot about George Church and his lab, can you explain?
Well, he's like 6'5", a genius, massive beard. He's hilarious. People don't realize this. Like, outside of being a genius, he's actually hilarious. Like, I don't think he means to, but on a lot of calls, I will start laughing at something he says. And sometimes I think maybe people miss it or they don't know what to do. And I will just start laughing. He also has narcolepsy, which is also fascinating. So he's just this really, he's a national treasure, right? Like he's like this super tall, super interesting, super smart, narcoleptic guy. that's also hilarious. And he's the nicest guy maybe you'll ever meet. And he's also just really, really funny. That's actually my favorite attribute about him. I literally laugh on every call we have. And then a lot of times we will schedule calls. And we've gotten into a good trend that we typically schedule calls now in the afternoon, later afternoon, because our calls that were supposed to be 30 minutes around a topic will turn into like 90 minutes or longer. And then we'll go into space and wizards or whatever. We just talk about all kinds of weird stuff, right? Like he and I's conversations kind of go everywhere. But look, George is one of those guys that can talk at the highest level about like a hard, complex thing in a way that you can understand it, but then instantly drill down to a level of depth that you're like, oh my gosh, how is he an expert on so many things? And so it is a true joy every day to get to work with him.
And he's spun out something like 50 biotech companies, startups out of his lab, some of which I talked to Octant Bio a while back, and Sri had worked in George Church's labs, even founders who just go on to start biotech companies later in life. It's one of the most famous in the world, right?
And it deserves it. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough also, we in addition to George being a co-founder and George and I collaborating pretty closely on the project, and George is being awesome. The people that he recruits to the lab are just amazing. And so our head of biological sciences, Ariona, came out of the church lab. Evan came out of the church lab. Justin came out of the church lab. So we have a partnership with Harvard and the church lab. But then outside of that partnership, we've also recruited some incredible postdocs out of his lab that work now full time at Colossal. And he creates just a really great environment for collaboration as well as discovery. I mean, he encourages people going after like really hard, interesting projects, right? And so when you attract that level of talent and then you kind of once again give them the support they need, it's pretty awesome. It's pretty great to watch what all spins out of the lab and the technologies that, you know, George is involved in. He's involved with a lot of stuff, which is great.
As you may have heard, I'm a big fan of what Marketer Hire is doing to make it easy for startups to find marketing talent. Getting the right marketing professionals takes way too long for ambitious businesses. But using advanced AI and in-house vetting, Marketer Hire makes finding your perfect match so much faster. You'll have access to elite freelance marketing professionals ready to work as little or as much as you need. Sign up today or get matched with a no-risk trial at marketerhire.com. What's one technology that you're building right now that you can go really deep on that you think is one of the more interesting projects or problems that you've worked on?
You know, I am not a biologist, so I don't know how deep I can go on any of the topics. I think I know enough to be dangerous, but I am very attracted to the exodev work, right? The artificial womb work, because the applications for it span so many different industries. They have such a ramification in so many categories. So I'm very, very fascinated with that, right? It's like, if you want to save the northern white rhinos, having one that is probably a viable surrogacy candidate and that's it is, you know, with a 16-18 month gestation, that's hard. That, like, how do you do that at scale? You really don't, right? So you're almost fighting a losing battle. The idea that you can grow 20 artificial wombs or 20 northern white rhinos or more in a lab, work with, you know, incredible conservation partners to rewild them, that's how you can save an entire population of animals and an entire species or subspecies, which I find incredibly fascinating. But that's a hard challenge, right? If you kind of look at like the Carnegie scale of how development works in the first phase of development all the way through gestation, all the way through birth. It's interesting. And there's gaps along the way. A lot of people obviously focus on humans, pig and mouse models because of a myriad of reasons for human healthcare, right? If you build an artificial womb, it's not going to work for humans and elephants and mice and horses and marsupials, right? You've got to be thoughtful about kind of not just the nutrient, excrement, and gas exchange, but you've got to be thoughtful about kind of like the placental, and then how do you handle that? Is that done through a pump exchange system? Is that going to be done? Because that can, once you get to the point that you have, once an animal gets to the point that it can have an umbilicus, we've seen incredible work where you can do kind of late stage all the way to term development, which is really interesting. But, how do you go through the point of attachment? How do you go through the point of modularity where you could have different species attaching under kind of one fabric or framework? And so people have solved and studied early stage, they've studied late stage. There's some stuff in the middle in development biology, depending on the species, where the knowledge curve and the knowledge gaps both exist in kind of interesting proportion to each other. And so I'm very fascinated about it because there's hard engineering challenges in it, but I feel like we know enough about it to get pretty far in the process. And like anything, we're treating it like a software product. So we're very, very iterative in kind of our approach to it.
Are we close on that? I remember when I was in school for biomedical engineering, the early stages of pregnancy, from 1 cell to 1,000 cells to, that is wildly complicated and far more than you'd guess. And it sounds like from your breakdown that once it has an umbilical cord, there have actually been studies in artificial wombs. But is that something that's like 5 years out?
I don't think the later stage is even easy, so I don't want to necessarily mischaracterize it at all. No, I mean there's, I mean once again, it depends on the organism and what model organism you're looking at, right? Like it's come a long way in mouse models in even the last 18 to 24 months. Like it's come a long way in a very, very short period of time. The later stage stuff, I wouldn't say it's easier. We understand enough about the nutrient and gas exchange and the excrement exchange and whatnot, because you're at some level you're hooking up wires, right? And then just managing pressure both in the inside the device and then obviously in the tubes. But on the earlier stage, a lot has, because we've come a long way on the imaging and developmental biology. I think looking at mouse and marsupial models are very interesting because of the speed at which obviously they gestate, but I think also understanding the difference is between the developmental biology when it comes into looking at the placental structures, right? And or lack of placental structures in most of the cases of marsupials. So I think understanding all that's pretty interesting, but we are also getting, so we're getting pretty far along with all of kind of the transcription factor work and all of the stem cell reprogramming work. And so that kind of plays a role into it of like, okay, how do you take something from an induced pluripotent stem cell all the way? Like, let's not just take egg cells and fertilize them, right? But how do you create them and then take them through that process, right? And so, yeah, the work in the last like 18 months has come so far. How close we are? I think that we are within 4 to 5 years, maybe a little less, maybe three on, marsupial and mouse type models. But I do think that there's a couple points along the way that will require the highest level of lift from an engineering challenge perspective, because what you don't want to be doing is trying to quickly transport and then, you don't want to grow something to a certain stage and then, once it develops an umbilicus, then try to, do like microsurgery on it, like what we've seen in some of the later stage work with lambs and pigs. There's just not, you want something that can go full term. So anyway, lots of challenges, but I want to, I think that, we've, de I think devoted the right level of resources to it, based on the success that they achieve over the next few years, we'll continue to, invest heavily in that category. But no, I want to say that it's 4 to 5 years away.
So if it works, you'll have artificial wombs that can be used to rebuild populations of endangered or even extinct animals, and a team of people building a whole studio of things that go along with that.
I wouldn't say if. I mean, it's just like I said, there's, it's just resources and it's just focus and funding, right? So as long as we continue to have the right people, the right focus, the right funding, which we do, then I don't think it's an if, it's just a when. But yeah, that's the game plan.
So over the next 3 months, what has to go right for this company to take off?
When you're working on projects with this event horizon, there's nothing in the next 3 months that will make or break us in terms of taking off. You know, I'd argue that we've taken off. The fact that we've brought such an incredible team together and raised $75 million in the Series A is, you know, a testament to the technology, the vision, and the team, right? Because that's what you're betting on in the early stages. So I don't think there's anything in the next 3 months that we have to achieve. I would like us to, you know, continue to hit our milestones on the biology side, which we're ahead of schedule on most. And so I feel confident that we'll continue to hit it. But there's nothing, I know it's kind of not the best answer for you, but there's nothing in the next 3 months that kind of makes or breaks us in terms of like takeoff, because we all have such a long event horizon company focus.
Yeah. Normally when I'm talking to, you know, SaaS companies that have an 18-month timeline to
they're like, oh my gosh, if I get to 200 MMR, then I'm, you know, it's a game changer. Yeah. So we're not as focused on that right now.
Yeah. Less reoccurring revenue milestones, more fundamental biology and commercialization.
And we're running a lot of experiments in parallel, right? That's one of the things that's incredible is like we've got an incredible biology team that's broken out into a bunch of different kind of micropods. And then they are, and different ones are running different experiments. So like I said, I think I mentioned this earlier, the rate of discovery is very high, which is awesome. I don't think that will be the case forever on all topics, but it's very, very high. Because we have people that are working on stem cell biology at the same time that we have people that are working on stem cell reprogramming at the same time that people with an embryology lab that's just working on somatic cell nuclear transfer in elephants and rhinos. So it's interesting, right? It's like we have different, you know, functional groups. So it's not like a, you know, oh, we're going to do A and then we'll do B. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to work on X through Z while we're working on A, B, C. So it's interesting just to see kind of the different discoveries get made at the different horizon points.
If you were starting from scratch, what's one thing you would do differently?
I don't know if I would do a lot differently. I think that we made the conscious decision to be very public with what we're working on because we believe in radical transparency. And while that sometimes is painful, I think it's really, really important. It's not like we got to an embryo and said, oh my gosh, we have a mammoth embryo. So that was a major decision point of like, you know, we raised the capital in stealth. Did we really need to talk about it? But we did feel that we wanted this not to be a colossal thing and an America thing. We wanted this to really be kind of a world and humanity thing. So we made that conscious decision. I think that was kind of one of the biggest decisions that we made early on was how transparent do we want to be? And we decided that we want to be as transparent as we can be outside of like core technology. And we wanted to be pretty radical transparent from day one and to let people know our intentions. You know, as we don't share every breakthrough or milestone, but as major milestones, we'll continue to share, you know, with the public. But yeah, I don't know if there's been anything. It's too soon to tell. Maybe it would be a great question, you know, because we're only, you know, 6 months from launch. So potentially an incredible question to ask me 3 years from now of like, would you have parallel path another species? Would you have, you know, who knows? You know, I think that in the coming, you know, years will probably be a pretty interesting question to do some introspection on.
What does launch look like?
Well, launch for us is just telling the world what we're working on and whatnot. You know, that's the company launch. Our, you know, while we will spin out technology companies on the way in technology products, on the way to the mammoth, I think that really kind of our biggest milestone is the birth of our first set of calves, which we hope to have in the next 4 to 6 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible.
Which sounds like an eternity when you're in my seat, but then, you know, because we do so much in such a short period of time. But then, so for me, I just think that sounds so long from now, but you know, it's actually in the scope of things pretty small in terms of what we're trying to achieve.
Well, bringing a species back to life in 4 to 6 years.
A lot of great people, though, you know, there's fundamental work that was done for a long time that kind of allowed us to get to where we are, right? And so it's not like we were just starting from scratch, right? Like we were fortunate enough to have George and the team be working on this for, you know, the better part of a decade.
So you're pretty deep in this biotech market right now. Beyond Colossal, what's one company that you think is fascinating that everyone will be talking about in a few years?
Well, I think there's a whole slew of stem cell reprogramming technologies, right? Looking at these transcription factors, whether that's for skin, hair. I'm sure you've seen the stuff that Bezos has been working on with Alto Labs, mm-hmm. Around human longevity. So I feel like human longevity for a long time was this like pseudoscience, you know, kind of category, right? Where people are like, hey, it's probably thoughtful, or it's probably, I assume people were like, oh, it's pretty smart to be thinking about human life and aging as a disease state, even though it hasn't been classified by the NIH. But I think that thought process, you know, over the last 5 to 10 years has kind of led us to this point where we will have a myriad of technologies and companies around that sector. And I think that one of the companies that's focusing on, and we're not affiliated with, but we love the guys over at Rejuvenate Bio, they're doing some really interesting things in dogs. And they're actually, you know, showing how they're helping different disease states in dogs as different aging related disease states in dogs, and how, you know, how could that be applied to humans? I think that the entire category of stem cell reprogramming of cells is really, really fascinating. And I think we're going to see amazing companies that will allow humanity to do everything from regrow hair to replenish skin cells to, you know, even have some of the more kind of fundamental, not the specific phenotype, but the fundamental technologies that will go into age reversal or slowing down and increasing the health span in humans. So I think that category is really fascinating. We get to dabble in that, right? Because we're doing stem cell reprogramming and we have some stem cell reprogramming technologies, but we're not focused on life extension or human longevity. But I think to me, that's probably the most exciting, you know, field, right? Because if you can reprogram stem cells effectively, you can solve a lot of issues in humans and help people in so many ways. Outside of the longevity side, the actual, how do you help people with aging skin or burn victims or people that need a certain type of like heart tissue that it doesn't exist other than a full heart transplant? I think it's a really fascinating area.
That is fascinating. I mean, everything going on with longevity is just like, I think from the outside, it still does look like pseudoscience, but the more you dive into it, looking at aging as a coordinated process, fascinating.
There's some real stuff there that's amazing. And I think that it's a category that so many people are very interested in. And while it doesn't have NIH funding, it will get a lot of really great funding for the private sector.
Ben, my last question for everybody on the show is about vision. Where would you like to see Colossal Biosciences in 20 years?
Well, I mean, I hope that we've successfully brought back mammoths and rewilded them back into the Arctic. You know, I think that that's a very reasonable goal in that time frame, hopefully much shorter. So yeah, I think that's a good vision and good goal. I think if we hit our expectations, and then maybe we'll have, you know, a few other species that can also help with the degraded ecosystems. So I think if we could successfully rewild the mammoth as well as a handful of other species, then it would have been a massive success.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Ben, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Anytime.